Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Sans Pants Radio, Australia's happiest podcast network.
Hey everyone, welcome to Bookish. I'm George DeMorales. This is a show where we ask you what's your story and what does it say about you. Today on the show, we have a filmmaker and an academic at Deakin University. He's currently capturing stories of cultural flows and its impact on Indian diaspora in Australia, as well as authoring and editing books on Indian cinema and intangible cultural heritage, Dr. Vikrant Kishore. How are you? Welcome to the show.
Hi, George. I'm all good and thanks for inviting me to your show.
That's okay. I think I managed to get all that that description down. It's a pleasure to have you here on the show. I saw your specialty there in Indian cinema. I was very fascinated to hear more. It's an actual area that I don't know a lot about. Is that something you've, like, I guess, firstly, have you always been interested in all film, or was it always specifically in Indian cinema?
No, I'm a film buff. So all kinds of cinemas. So right from Western films to European films to even African films, to any films, or Korean or Japanese. In fact, lately I have been teaching Asian cinemas, so from Japan to Taiwan to China to Hong Kong cinema. So, but my speciality, or rather my focus and research area, is of course Indian cinema, which I've grown up watching. So that of course is the area where I write, and I really like to discuss and talk about more about that.
Yeah. Now, that's to be honest, you've got like the classic, you've got a film buff's dream, since your job now involves like watching movies and dissecting them all the time. It sounds like what a lot of people would love to have, to be honest.
Yeah. And that's what I keep telling students, like earlier when, teachers would say, don't watch film, don't watch TV. In our course, we ask students to go and watch as many movies as possible, watch as many TV as possible. Yeah. And even that sounds sometimes, a bit too much to ask, because, the engagement sometimes is not the way you want it. But still, students love watching movies. And these days I'm teaching documentary production. And lots of students who have never been, in a way engaged with documentary, and suddenly, they get started, and then they realize that documentaries are such a huge kind of area, and there are lots of interesting films. It is no more about, dull and drab kind of filmmaking. It has become very stylistic as well. So another area, just from Indian cinema, now I'm also talking about documentaries, which I teach now mostly.
All right, okay. Yeah, because I know what you mean. I mean, your documentary, whilst interesting, no one thinks of it as, like, I guess, artistic, creative in the same sense of a movie. But you're saying that actually that's changed, and now there's way more of a stamp that these filmmakers put on what they're putting out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's so much of change in documentary filmmaking which has happened. And now I'm also focusing on micro storytelling. So short stories, or short documentary style of 2 to 3 minutes to 6 minute kind of storytelling. And that's another thing with the coming of online media and the changing media landscape, that has really taken away from that long form, though long form still is there and it is the most, mostly watched, but short form storytelling has also now become very, common.
Right. Yeah. Is that like YouTube sort of stuff?
Yeah. YouTube, like online, Facebook, Vimeo, you name it. And lots of storytellers are utilizing those kind of medium to reach out to masses and to a greater audience, not masses, but a online audit.
No, you could say the masses, which you just meant it in the mathematical sense rather than in any mean way. That's interesting because, like, obviously the first thing, whenever I hear that, a part of me is like, oh, it's a shame that people can't pay attention for longer. But I guess it's not really saying that. It's more like just getting where people are looking, essentially. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's now the thing is that people have got a choice. You know, earlier we didn't have a choice. We were sticking to a particular long format films. So now people have choice that they can choose between short format or whatever, depending on their time. So I still end up watching lots of, you know, feature films and feature documentaries. But still, you know, when I don't have time, I can still browse through and watch these short, interesting films which are being made. So there's some amazing work coming. And I can see, you know, 20 years back, we would be struggling, you know, wanting to showcase our films to a broader audience. And online media has changed. Now you just put it on your Facebook, immediately your friends would start reacting, your family would start, you know, watching the things, and then it can travel. Things can travel.
Yeah. And there's also, I guess, it's almost because it's short, you get to practice things and you get to work on it faster as well. Instead of the long process of a long form thing, you can really build up your skills. I'm guessing long form is still considered the big one, I guess, even though like the short form's gotten more popular. Or is that just me showing my age, showing my out of touchness with tech?
Yeah, no, I agree. Long forms are still here to stay, but short forms are also something, you know, which is growing. And especially for people who are just getting into media or wanting to explore filmmaking or making, documentaries, for them it becomes easy because to explore, you know, storytelling and to also engage with an audience, online audience. So that is also good. And somehow it also helps them to explore the pathway towards long form of filmmaking or feature filmmaking. And especially teaching at university, we are trying to teach all these kind of skills to the students of how to, you know, work with a crew and how to tell a story in 6 minutes or 10 minutes. And once they are done with that, then they move on to, you know, bigger production houses and all to make feature length films. And then now with corporates also opening up, they are wanting students to come with those kind of multi-skills. So multi-skilling is also becoming very important. It's not just that you have to be a kind of a specialist camera person or a specialist director or kind of thing. You can be a jack of all.
Yeah. Which, you need to know a little bit about everything now just to be able to be, I'm guessing the agileness of it, being able to, you know, move quick and cover lots of bases, which, yeah, for that you would need experience in lots of areas. I was going to talk about your book and the cars and the Indian cinema, but you've got me interested because the one thing that straight away pops into my head when we talk about something like this, and it's unavoidable with documentary in general in the modern era, especially when we talk about internet-based information, I guess, is the downside, which is obviously the misinformation abilities. And obviously the shorter it is, even though I'm sure, you know, any length of time you can make something up, I guess. But with something like 4 to 6 minutes, obviously you can almost make anything look real in that length of time. So is that something which gets discussed? Is that like an ethical thing which comes up, or is that just like, that's just part of it?
Yeah, no, that's a very big thing, especially as a documentary filmmaker. I always think that, the way propaganda machineries are working and these kind of, you generally see those kind of very new style of presentation of things and trying to give it a spin. And that is happening so much that you have to keep your eyes and mind open. And I see people taking up, you know, understanding or rather thinking these kind of spinned stories or propaganda stories to be real. And that's why you see that kind of divide or the rise of the right wing with these kind of stories. And then the book that I want to discuss today, you know, which is Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. Mm-hmm. In fact, she opens up talking about the American society and culture in relationship to, you know, the 2016, elections and later on what happens with the Trump and the right wing's rise. And then she analyzes the whole misinformation that has been spread and that kind of division between in the American society about the ultra whites and then, you know, how it impacts others. So I find, you know, somewhere our discussion coming to that kind of a segue of moving into our book discussion as well, because it's a very important kind of a book that I found very interesting, and also something which in Indian kind of a parallel, because she also utilizes lots of aspects from the Indian caste system. And as I said, I utilize lots of my storytelling from the cultural perspective. Mm. So one of the cultural baggage these days I see within the Indian diaspora is the baggage of caste and the practice of caste within the Indian diaspora in Australia. I find it a bit problematic, because what they do is that they bring in those kind of, the age-old practice of discrimination.
Yeah. That's okay. Yeah, you've tied things together better than I usually do. Okay, there's so much to unpack in what you've just mentioned. So, firstly, I guess to take a step back, the book Caste, in terms of I always thought it was pronounced Caste when I was younger, but Caste, which is about, so the book is essentially about how different subgroups within society, in this case, she's specifically talking about America, and how that's based on a historical basis as well as it's helped along by current proceedings. Is that right? Like, I'm not exactly sure what the book.
Yeah, yeah. So to sum up, I would say it's just a work which looks at the nature of inequality, and specifically in United States, and with some of the aspects that happened in India and also Nazi Germany. So she looks at the aspects of slavery, class, and race as a construct for inequality, and also the aspect of economic need that prompts these kind of inequalities. So that's very important. So, and she looks at the kind of hierarchy which is at the work, whites at the top, black at the bottom, you know, and also looking at caste discrimination as a global human rights concern.
Yeah, I guess what's interesting, and this is why this has caught my eye so much, is when you told me this is the book. So I didn't even know this existed. Then I looked it up and it won the 2020 Pulitzer Prize. And it sounds super fascinating, because straight away my first thought is, it's interesting labeling it as castes instead of class, because, like, obviously that's the it's got a different meaning. Like, and I get the classic, you yourself said, the Indian culture, or at least what it was, that was, the caste system was huge there. It was very deeply entrenched. How many were there in the Indian culture? Is there a lot, or is there four clear-cut ones? I can't remember.
Yeah, that's the Varna system in Hinduism. So that's in Varna that there are four divisions. But out of those four divisions, there are multiple castes. So one Varna can have, you know, hundreds of castes within there. So in India, you'll find castes and subcastes. So if you divide in terms of Varna, it's a huge historical thing, which I have to unpack here. But to keep it simple, there are four Varna system, which supposedly, you know, there is a, at the top are the Brahmins in India, who are the knowledge giver. The second one are the Kshatriyas, who are the rulers or the warrior class. Then third one is the Vaishyas, who are the trading class. And fourth one is the Shudras, who are the menial worker. But then there is also a fifth kind of a division, who are out of this fold and who were supposedly called the untouchables. Okay.
Yeah.
And they had to face and fight the major discrimination that till date happens. Till date, you know, there's lots of killing and lots of kind of problems that you see and you hear. And it's not only in India, and I think most of the South Asia. And caste also, you know, traveled from Hinduism to Islam in India to Buddhism. Though Buddhism was, you know, in a way kind of a, you know, escape from that caste thing. But even in Buddhism also, they created those kind of divisions. Even in Christianity in India, we have called Dalit Christians, or people who converted from the so-called untouchable caste to Christians, yet they did not get the same kind of, you know, they were not considered equal. So it's a very interesting kind of a, you know, thing which has happened.
It's so interesting, because, like, I mean, straight, and I've got no idea about this. So if I say anything dumb, you just hope you understand that. But the first thing I straight away think is, like, are people born, like, into that caste, and, like, is it in their name or something? Like, is there a record of the caste people are?
Yes, yes, you are absolutely right. Well, caste, when it started, the practice, it was supposedly, or whatever the old texts say, that it is according to your karma, if you work. So if you are a knowledge giver, if you are in academia, then you are from the supposedly the higher caste. then if you are a warrior, then you can go. And it could be changed, like if your son or daughter becomes something else, you know, they can be considered of that. But later on to, you know, families wanting to protect their kind of, you know, domain or the field that they are working in. So they made it by birth. And then in India, you will see that the surnames, okay, generally reflect your caste. And that's why if you meet Indians or whenever Indians, if they meet each other, generally they will always stress on what is your last name, because they want to create a kind of a relationship out of your last name, thinking, oh, they might be from our same caste. Maybe we'll gel more or we can become friends more. Yeah, and it happens here in Australia that people always stress, you know, not directly, but indirectly it will come. And I have experienced it so many times that it is just, you know, at times you feel like, why? You know, why so many people come to Australia or lots of Western countries, want to get the best out of a multicultural society, a democratic liberal setup, want to also call themselves as minority, and yet have that kind of prejudice to practice a certain form of discrimination with their own people. And that's why I call it cultural baggage. So some of the cultural baggage that could have been just, you know, moved away from. You, if somebody, you know, kicks, and it's not that everyone is like that. It's just, you know, you'll say a kind of a minority segment at the moment. But till the time that practice is alive and well and kicking, then there is a problem. And that's what my problem is, that why, you know, people think about caste still, you know, wanting to, you know, claim that kind of, situation or claim to be, you know, discriminated on the basis of racism and feel, you know, a bit in a kind of a foreign land, being, you know, the outsider. You understand racism,
yeah,
but you do not accept your casteism.
Yeah, because that's what I was going to get to as well. What's interesting is, like, from what you're describing, is this a case where even people who weren't born in India, who maybe you could forgive for being a bit more stuck on those old cultural practices, but even their kids are still, in many instances, holding on to these kind of attitudes. Is that the case?
Yeah. And that's there. And it is transferred. So it's, again, I'll say, not all are like that,
yeah,
but no, majority.
A lot, you know, of people, yeah. So simply, but yeah, a lot of, I didn't know this existed.
Well, it's a big thing. It's a big thing. And now, because there are lots of, people, a kind of a resurgence or not resurgence, but in a kind of a, people are now talking about this issue. And because people are talking about this issue, lots of people are getting defensive about their caste practice, you know. So, and then calling others is, you know, the other day I shared on my Facebook a kind of a meme, and it said someone from privileged class saying that, why are you all always talking about caste, you know? And the other person responds that, we at least talk about caste, you practice it. That's why you don't need to, you know, talk about it.
Yeah. It's the classic one. It's like, yeah, if you're not feeling any of the negative impacts on it, you're like, this isn't a problem.
Yeah.
But yes, to go tie it to the book is what you're saying as well. The reason I find this interesting, and even your description of Indian castes as they were originally were anyway, you're saying the number one, the highest is the knowledge giver, and then the military ruler class, and then the trades caste. But obviously, I'm guessing in modern society, that order wouldn't be the same anymore, would it?
Well, it wouldn't be same. It is different because then capitalist structure generally that rules.
Exactly.
You know, the trader class is the main, you know, they make the changes and all. But in India, still that caste equation in Indian or South Asian, I should use the South Asian. And when I use the term South Asian, I also, I want to club the diasporic South Asian, because they are the ones who are also taking those baggages abroad. So, you know, if today in USA there's lots of discussion about caste, it's because of that baggage has been brought in there. And that's why I find, Wilkerson's book very, very important book, because this is, and trying to look at the American society on the basis of caste, which people never thought about it earlier. And she is, you know, breaking that kind of, she's doing that analysis and in a very kind of a powerful way that, you know, really made people to understand caste. And she's using, you know, again, India as the birthplace of caste, and Nazi Germany, where the modern experiments of casteism was done, you know, the Aryan theory, and how they, you know, tried to create a kind of unequal state and you know, also kind of a being very barbaric in their approach as well.
Yeah, no, that's why this sounds like a very current topic. So you've already mentioned the personal thing. So were you born here, or were you born in India?
No, I was born in India. I came here to do my PhD. So I did my PhD in Indian cinema and representation of folk dance forms in Indian cinema. So I did it from RMIT University. And now it's been more than 17 years since I've been here. But I worked back in India. I worked as a journalist and then an academic teaching media. And so those kind of experiences really helped me to, you know, start thinking about what kind of work I want to do. And filmmaking is something which, you know, I've been interested in. I've been making films. So yeah, I always combine my work as an academic, a filmmaker, and a journalist. All three things go hand in hand. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So. There's so many topics I want to cover at the same time with everything you say. So just to stick on that though, just quickly. So you had an interesting experience because you probably, being born in India and raised there, you would have seen the caste system there, and you're maybe a bit more aware of its impact on what it's like here in Australia in the diaspora, because you think you're leaving it behind, but then you see it's the long fingers of that culture still around you today, maybe more so than someone who was just born here and doesn't appreciate like how obvious it is, I guess. Is that a thing to say, or is that something you know?
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, having a lived experience of how caste operated back in India, and also coming from that so-called, I really hate to say that, but yes, we were treated like untouchables. And that was the thing. And coming from that privileged class, I was from a privileged class because my, you know, father was a very high, big officer, and my grandfather was a member of parliament and a minister. So we got all those kind of privileges where we never had to go through kind of daily problems of casteism. It's only when at my school, due to competitive nature, that people, when they could not bring me down on the basis of class and the kind of things that I could achieve, they could only, you know, point fingers at me on the basis of my caste to bring me down as to why are you here? What are you doing? You belong to someone who shouldn't be even in school, that kind of thing.
Really?
And those were the kind of problems, you know, and okay. I had to fight it. And it went on at different ways, different levels. So, you know, I'm just simplifying it, you know. So
Yeah. It's just interesting because, like you said, it's not related to even socioeconomic or even achievement in the government, whatever. It's that people still use it, I guess, as a club, even though you've – like the whole family's shown it. Yeah, it's so interesting that the culture, like, I mean, I'm not dismissing the pain of something like that, but the fact that it can be so complicated, I guess.
Yeah, it is complicated. And when you come to Australia and then you meet another Indian, and then the first thing they want to know is what is your last name? Because they want to, you know, get your identity. They want to know which caste you belong, because that's how they would form those kind of, a kind of a bonding. Some people do that. And I've had at least 5-6 incidents like that, and where I've been really, really like, why the hell? Like, till the moment I was talking to the person, you know, they felt very nice and everything. And suddenly that casteist or caste discrimination attitude comes out, and then suddenly everything goes like, ah. You are also bringing that here. And right now, 5 minutes back, you're talking about how you, you know, faced racism while you came to Australia. And you just showed me your caste's color. I was like, it just makes me something amused, but at the same time, angry as well.
Yeah. Well, I can understand why. Like, as in, when you think you're getting free from that, and then it just still pops up in the, in a new place where you wouldn't think so. Just because it is a topic that I was interested in as well. So from the point of view of, like, to switch now to the Indian cinema stuff for a moment, because that's something I think a lot of people would be very interested in. Because when you say Indian cinema, and again, I'm sure you hear this a lot, but I'm guessing that's more than just Bollywood, or is that like, is Bollywood, you know, people think of that when they think of Indian cinema, obviously. But that's not what all Indian cinema is, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. At the moment you say Indian cinema, it's a huge industry. Okay. And there's not one industry, but there are more than 15-16 language industries. So there is Hindi film industry, which in India is known as Bollywood. Okay. So Hindi film industry, which is the largest film industry. But then also there are other very large industries like the Tamil film industry, Telugu film industry, Malayalam film industry. So these are all from specific states, Bengali, Bhojpuri. There's so many language-based industries.
Really?
Yeah. And that's how India makes 1,000 films a year. So it's Indian film industry makes 1,000 films, but Bollywood or the Hindi film industry, they end up making about 200 or 220 films a year. Rest comes from the other kind of languages. But the difference between, because the commercial or the mainstream films from India generally has few things common, you know, because they will be a kind of a family entertainer with 5 or 6 song and dance. So when people watch, especially in Western countries, when they watch those kind of mainstream films, which works on a certain formula.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Because they don't understand the difference between languages, for them, anything with song and dance and a kind of a melodrama and kind of things, for them, it will always sound to them as Bollywood. So in my book, Bollywood and Others, I actually, you know, I said that for Westerners, Indian mainstream cinema is equal to Bollywood. But for an Indian, Hindi cinema is Bollywood. So that's the difference that we make, because, you know, because we can understand the difference between language. But for a Westerner, till the time it is following a similar plot of certain formula and coming from India with song and dance, for them, it's Bollywood.
Right. Yeah, I know. It's the classic. It's the only one you hear about. So that's what you think. Yeah. Again, grouping everything under one thing, I think.
Yeah. So generally, I say Bollywood has become a brand name for Indian cinema.
Yeah, but so are you saying that the other film industries within India, they also do the song and dance thing as well, or are you saying they're completely different styles?
They also do. The mainstream cinemas, generally song and dance is something everybody wants and everybody likes. I love Indian song and dance sequences. And these days it's getting lesser and lesser, and they are trying to follow lots of Hollywood and European style of filmmaking, which, it's good. But I really want my song and dance in films. So there are different styles of films. You know, Malayalam film from Kerala, they are so rich. They are so, you know, intense films that very focused on storyline, that you will fall in love with those kind of films. Or in 60s, all the Bengali films, or avant-garde Bengali films by Satyajit Ray and all, those were, you know, really talked about. Or if you look at Telugu cinema, it has another kind of very high octane kind of gangster films, or, you know, it has its own kind of over the top films, or Tamil films, again, very over the top, very star based. And in fact, you'll see, while in Bollywood or in Hindi cinema, you'll find the star system dominating, and the stars are, you know, in a way, they are emulated and people really like the stars. The moment you go to South India, the stars are like gods. They are worshipped. They have temples. So a star says that don't vote for this politician. People will not vote for that politician.
Really?
And few of the stars, they end up becoming premiers of, you know, a state. So that's the kind of star power that is in South India. They really love the film. Not like, you know, the way in North India, they also love their films. But in South India, that kind of passion and, you know, following for their stars and films is huge.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, okay. I mean, you hear things. It's interesting. Again, it's a few things there. Like, firstly, the fact that, like, there is no one India, right? It's completely different areas and how they react to things. So I think that's an issue that people fall into from outside looking in.
And then that's what has happened, that lots of times, you know, because Hindi film has been so well known and it has been exported abroad so much, that lots of times these regional films, or which are as strong as Hindi films, I shouldn't be saying regional films, but other films which are as popular or as powerful as Hindi cinema, they felt marginalized because, you know, lots of times they didn't get the exposure. But thanks to now, again, another different kind of a perspective of OTT platforms with subtitled, with dubbed, you know, access to these films all over the world, you know, it has got, you know, really, really big. And people now, I've been watching lots of these films, which earlier, because of lack of knowledge of those languages and no subtitles, that I wouldn't watch. Now I end up watching those movies more than my own Hindi cinema. And I love those. I love those films.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, they get subtitled so you can see, you can know what's going on with the film. Is that a, okay, firstly, how can you possibly, that's so many movies a year. Your job's hard enough with the rest of the world. You're telling me Indian cinema, I didn't realize it was that level of output a year. That's wild.
Yeah. It's a huge, huge film industry. And the passion for cinema still remains. And if you look at, in Australia, like when I came here in 2006, there would be only three theaters or two to three theaters in Melbourne, rather, showing, you know, really popular Bollywood films, maybe once in a month kind of a thing. Mm-hmm. 2021, any average Indian cinema, be it Hindi cinema, be it Punjabi cinema or Tamil cinema, they will end up getting 50 to 80 theaters. Okay. And that's a huge jump.
And here now in Melbourne, Indian, you mean?
In Australia.
In Australia, okay.
So in Melbourne, at least, you know, 20, 25 theaters will be running a show. So biggest consumers are Melbourne and Sydney, of course. So, and you'll find the diaspora, Indian diaspora, South Asian diaspora here, the maximum. So yeah, that has been a huge change. And they are now featuring in top 10, you know, grosses among the Australian top 10 films. So that's another huge kind of change. And what is the kind of population who's watching these films? It's less than 1.5% of Australian population watching. And yet they are able to, you know, get them that kind of money. So, you know, the popularity of Bollywood cinema is becoming huge because the growing diasporic or South Asian population in Australia. And now even Australians are engaging with it. Recently, I was talking to one of the distributors and she was telling me that she got a request from a drive-in in Dubbo to screen Bollywood film, and then they screened Bollywood film and it was very well liked, and they are asking them to send more. So, you know, now films are going to regional cities from, you know, Warrnambool to Geelong to Newcastle and other places. So it's just no more confined to just capital cities now.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I guess, is this a case where the Indian culture, if it sounds like it celebrates, if it's got the biggest movie industry in the world, I believe, it is a trait where, like, in Indian culture, to go watch movies at the cinema? Is that a thing that, like, people do more, I guess?
Absolutely. Cinema going is one of the cultural things, and people like to watch their, you know, stars on screen. When I came to Australia, I would hardly go to theaters till the time I wasn't, you know, making much. I had to pay all those big fee and all. So, you know, $20 to $30 used to look very large amount to go to theater.
Yeah.
But the moment when I went to one of the really popular films, which I really wanted to watch, I went to the theater and it was all, you know, house full. And that's one term Indians will use if the theater is all full. So it was a house full theater. And I didn't feel like I'm in Australia because people were whistling, people were, before the hero could sprout the dialogues, they were repeating the dialogue or saying the dialogue. And it was like, wow, I'm back to India, that kind of theater experience of not just quietly watching and let everybody enjoy, but it becomes a kind of a community feeling of everybody is, putting their own things or someone whistling or it was phenomenal.
It's funny. It's funny because like straight away what that makes you think of, and this is mainly thanks to cinema teaching me this, but that sounds a lot like what it's like for African-American communities in America, where it's like very like loud and just reactive to what's going on the screen. I have a bit of a, well, as long as it's not interrupting the movie experience, I do like a social viewing experience as long as it's not too much. Like, everyone's talking constantly. But I don't know, I haven't experienced what you're describing. So maybe it is fine still.
Yeah, that's one thing which we used to do when we used in 2008 and 2009. I was part of a, student field trip where, I had organized this in India for students from Deakin University to visit India. And then we organized for them to experience the Indian theater thing with all the whistling and all the dancing and everything. And they were just amazed by the kind of thing which was happening inside the theater. And these were the single screen theater. So not those multiplex in malls or, the modern where you have to be quiet or where you have to be really rich to go there. These were like, 20 cents ticket entry kind of a place where a big theater, getting in around 500 to 700 people in there, or some even 1,000, and then experiencing sitting in the, front stall where people generally, who are just fending themselves hand to mouth, they would spend some amount just to enjoy the film and the hero and the song and dance, and how people would throw coins when their favorite song and dance would come. So it was, students loved it. Yeah.
That is such a different experience. Like, that's so interesting to me because I do, like, it's funny. I've had the very mild version of that, which is like, there's a cinema here in Melbourne, Nova, which on Mondays has like, it's like cheap night Mondays, whatever. And it's funny because that's always when like all the local people from there will go. So it's like, if there's any sort of artsy sort of movie, because it's Cinema Nova anyway, and then it's a Monday, those ones are always going to be packed, and the vibe is really fun, but they're not actually getting into it that much. They're like laughing at all the right places, but they're not actually like as engaged at what you're describing, which sounds more like one of those watching parties that people do with like The Room or the Rocky Horror Picture Show or something.
Yeah. The Rocky Horror show probably comes close to it, but then that's the normal thing in single screen theaters. Of course, the multiplex experience is robbing that away because people are becoming more elitist and, not wanting to engage the way because suddenly there is a class division kind of a thing. Okay. But yet, it's a different.
So I guess now you mentioned that, and to tie it back with the book you mentioned with the cast and this, because whenever I think of cinema, I do think of like propaganda essentially is, but not in a negative sense, just in terms of cinema is a reflection of cultural values and norms that then get spread across the world, and whether that's good or bad and different views in that. What is the view in terms of, and again, I know Indian cinema is a huge broad thing, so generally, I guess, are these the kind of things it tackles? Does it talk about things like the caste system? Does it try to unpack it and make it better? Or is that something which actually it doesn't deal with enough?
Yeah, very relevant question here, George. And you are very right that in cinema, especially the mainstream cinema, and when in India, Indian cinema has often been dubbed as escapist fare or escapist cinema. And what it does is generally, in a way, it whitewashes or caste washes, okay? Or it represents only a specific class and specific caste. So the stories of the marginalized generally was reserved only to parallel cinema or alternate cinema, while mainstream cinema was always about rich people or people from higher caste, and there was only a kind of a lip service to those kind of issue-based stories. And that I have always found very problematic. And, lots of Hollywood films have whitewashed, things or situation. Or somewhere wanting to represent a black but you know, putting someone white in the role and, you know, putting paint on them, those kind of things.
No, that's okay. Showcasing, back in the day. You know,
yeah. So those are the kind of issues which Hollywood witnessed. In Indian cinema also, we find those kind of problems. But good thing is that while the mainstream Hindi cinema, it still, you know, tries to be very defensive and tries to be run away from these kind of facts. It is the regional cinemas, or again, I have this thing in stuck. I always call it regional cinema, but other, you know, strong cinema or from southern India, especially Kerala and Tamil Nadu, the cinemas which have really come and which are now decoding casteism and caste issues in mainstream cinema. You know, filmmakers like Paar Ranjit and Silva Raj and all these people are doing some tremendous job, and I'm amazed by the kind of work which is coming, and they are changing the narrative, and that's what is happening, and I'm really happy about it. Hindi cinema, still, it is stuck in, again, it's also about production and who controls the production, and that's a kind of a problem.
Yeah.
And those are, again, big political things. I don't want to get into that because it will just open up a kind of a can of worms about talking about, you know, how problematic it is. But yeah, at another level, I enjoy my Indian cinema. I enjoy my Hindi cinema. I enjoy the song and dance. I enjoy the escapist kind of cinema. So that's all there. So you know, at one side, I will defend my Indian cinema no matter what. But at another aspect, I will also criticize for it for not taking up the issues which mattered or which could have help people or which could have changed their stereotypical notion about, you know, in terms of class, in terms of caste, in terms of even about sexism kind of things. So I feel lots of these mainstream cinema are very sexist in nature and does not give enough to women as well, you know, the kind of roles that they should have been given.
Right. I guess that's reminding me, and even you mentioned about the race thing as well, and this might be a difficult question to answer, I'm not sure, but, you know, like in Hollywood right now, there's a big push to get more voices, I guess, behind the camera, to get them in roles of authority and things like that, in terms of like along race and sex lines. Is that a case where like there is a specific cast that deals mainly with like Hindi cinema, or is it quite equally spread? Is that a thing? Like, I'm just coming up with that.
No, unfortunately, no. The caste representation is hardly anywhere. And there is also a
behind the camera, like as in the people making it.
Yeah. It's generally they dismiss people. Generally those kind of, you know, because cinema or films have been such kind of, film schools have been, you know, very few. And most of the people getting access to those who have been from, you know, from well-to-do families generally. So those kind of representations have been very skewed, and you see in the kind of films that are being made. So from production to distribution to the behind the camera, all the technical things.
Oh,
it is changing. Again, it is changing, but it is taking a whole lot of time. You know, Indian cinema is now more than 100 years old, but till date, if somebody has to talk about, which was the film which represented caste very well, and one of the films which will always come is a 1936 film called Achhoot Kanya. Damn, 1936, 2021. When we count six films, you are taking that 1936 film as a landmark film which represented caste. And after that, you just have four. So you can just understand what I'm trying to say here.
Mm.
That, yes, it hasn't been done and people still require more participation and their storytelling. It is changing. But it will take a bit more time. I do think so.
Yeah, no, it's an angle I just never even considered, I guess. I understand looking at things through the class-based perspective, but the fact that this cast can have such an impact on things is, yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me. And that's actually why the book sounded so interesting, because it's splitting it by more than just class, which is like, okay, for example, and again, maybe this doesn't happen, but would there be families who get successful, let's say, and then actually actively try to change their caste, like maybe fudge their family history or something?
Well, the identity crisis is always there. And lots of times people try to hide their identity. Okay. And that has happened quite a lot. But generally, there are hardly few people out there. So yeah, so that's somewhat again the identity crisis due to caste or being from lower caste. It's again a big problem.
Wow.
And this is one thing which I'm at the moment talking, and I'm making a web series on that issue of you know narratives of Dalits in the Indian diaspora, and why do they feel marginalized, and then the story, one story which always comes out, that how once they achieve a certain class, the hiding or de-identifying them from a specific community, because the moment they identify themselves, the more the discrimination, the more looking down upon them, all those kind of things happens. But at least now we are talking about it. That's I would say.
I know you have to get going. I guess one more, just question. I'm just curious. When these classes as they exist in India, is every class in every area, or do certain areas only have like one city is just one type of class, or is it all quite spread out in that sense throughout the country?
No, it's spread out. India is a very contrasting country. Any city you will go, there will be a contrast. So there will be class and there will be caste. So an apartment, you know, a middle class apartment in Delhi would have all castes, but just next to the apartment, either in front of it or behind it, there will be a slum. And there will be all these people who are earning, you know, just, you know, maybe 50 cents a day or $1 a day. And they will be, you know, washing their clothes outside, taking baths outside. And then you come out of your apartment, you look at them and you don't talk to them. You just move on because your class is different. Mm. So your caste might be lower or whatever. So that, it's a kind of a
mixed
problem,
up, yeah.
You know.
It's this extra layer, different. Yeah, yeah.
And then recently, I think in 2020, when Trump was visiting one of the Indian cities, and there was this particular event. And then the government, you know, hit the slums, which was, you know, on his route, so that the foreigner dignitary Trump doesn't see India's poverty. Oh, it shouldn't be, evident to him that there are slums on the main roads, or there are poor people, you know, just doing the daily things on the road. So,
yeah, that's interesting. There's a lot more to unpack there than we can do in a short episode like this. I know you got to get going, so I guess I've got to let you go now. Unfortunately, even though I'd love to hear some more, we didn't even go into some more details about cinema, but that's okay. Thank you very much for being on. I guess one question for anyone listening, two questions. Firstly, is there any one you'd recommend as a starting point for Indian cinema? Let's say, I know we've said that it's wider than Bollywood, so maybe two examples, one classic of Hindi cinema, and then one you would say is an example of the range that's possible. Do you have anything come to mind?
Well, my favorite film, of course, is a curry western. As opposed to spaghetti western, we have got a curry western Bollywood film called Sholay, which was again a kind of a inspiration from Clint Eastwood films and, more made into a biggest Bollywood blockbuster called Sholay. Yeah. So spaghetti western, then there is curry western.
Yeah.
And Sholay or M. Ambers, it has been re-released again. It was made in 1975. I've watched that movie, you won't believe it, but every time that movie comes, I watch it. And I watch it whenever I have free time. And I watched it more than 100 times. So that's the movie I will say.
Okay.
Watch it. If you have time, 3.5 hours.
Three and a half. Okay.
So that's the Bollywood movie. Mm. And a recent film which has really, really, which is on Netflix as well. It's called Asuran. It's again a kind of a study on the caste divide of India. And it's on Netflix. Another Bollywood film, a bit of whitewashing, but still, which is interesting. And one of my students is the editor of that film, Yasha Ramchandani. And that film is called Article 15. It is also on Netflix. So Article 15, Asuran on Netflix. Sholay, you will get it on Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay. And if they're all that long, then you've committed me a whole weekend now to watching things.
Asuran is a shorter film, and Sholay only probably 3.5 hours. But we love it. We enjoy it. It's probably India's Rocky Horror Show kind of a thing that people will... Everybody remembers each and every dialogue of Sholay. You call it, it's a legend. You know, it's a big film.
Okay.
It's a film that, wow, Yeah.
Yeah. In terms of numbers, it's probably like one of the biggest movies ever made. It's like the amount of people that know it word for word, which is hilarious. And I guess finally, do you want anyone to follow you anywhere? Catch you on anything?
I would just ask the audience that, yeah, engage with Indian cinema. That's one thing I would really love to see more Australians engaging with Indian cinema, because it has lots more to offer. There are different stories. Okay, song and dance might be a constant thing, but you still have different genre from horror to family film to action film and all. And understanding a different culture and, of course, the growing Indian diaspora, it's there. And when you talk about Indian cinema, you know, Indians really love it. But more importantly, you know, it's always being open to, and that's what I find, that, Australians are more keen to engage with European cinema or American cinema, but South Asian cinema or Southeast Asian cinema, it's kind of zone which lots of people don't like to go. But why not? When we say multiculturalism, we need to embrace more. And and the more you start doing that, you will understand the culture, perspective, and more appreciation to others as well.
Definitely. Okay. Awesome. Well, thanks very much for being on. I guess that's it. So thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks, George.
Thanks for listening. If you want to help support this show and all the other shows we do here at Sans Pants Radio, then why not subscribe to SansPantsPlus.com? For as little as $5 a month, you could have access to a whole bunch of bonus shows and content. Once again, that's SansPantsPlus.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com. Code PROGRAM.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.